Hello, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. My name is Katerina Stoikova, and you are listening to Accents. This episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My guest today is the brilliant Tony Ann Johnson. Hi, Tony Ann. Welcome to Accents.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you again.
Wonderful to see you. You have a new book, a linked short story collection, But Where is Home? It was selected by Crystal Wilkinson to be published by Screen Door Press, an imprint of the University Press of Kentucky. That's very exciting because was that the inaugural book in the series?
Yeah. So it's a publication prize that comes with a little bit of money, and my book and one other book were the first books published by Screen Door Press. So the contest began in 2024, and our books both came out February of 2026.
First things first, please introduce us to the Arringtons.
Oh, okay. This book is a work of autobiographical fiction, like my previous book, Light Skin Gone to Waste, and my book that was published by Accents in 2021, Homegoing. So it's a series about this family. The Arrington families are a Black family. Phil and Velma Arrington moved from the Bronx to Monroe, New York in the early 1960s. And Phil has a daughter from a previous marriage who ends up staying living in the Bronx, but she visits on the weekends. And Phil and Velma then have Maddie about a year after they move to Monroe. And Maddie is the person who grows up there and has not lived anywhere else. So she's a Black girl in a 99% white town, and has some difficulty with that. However, she doesn't have anything to compare it to for a long time until she gets to know her cousin Susie, and she sort of sees, how Susie's life is where she lives, and she realizes it doesn't have to be the way it is for her, but that's how it is until she's able to get out.
Tell us about the new book. How is it different or similar to your other books that you mentioned, Homegoing and Light Skin Gone to Waste?
So Light Skin Gone to Waste focuses mainly on Maddie. There are stories from other characters' points of view, but Where's Home is more of a family saga. So Crystal's wonderful idea was to have a family tree in the beginning and a key to the characters. So we learn about who everybody is and what their backstories are. So we learn that Phil lost his father when he was a very young boy, and his mother was a difficult mother, withheld affection from him, so he didn't feel loved growing up, and that has led to some poor behavior on his part as he becomes an adult. And Velma was abandoned by her mother, who was struggling financially, lost custody of her, so Velma was adopted by another family, but that separation had an impact on her that she hasn't been able to really process. So she's not able to show up authentically in her relationship with Maddie. So she doesn't tell Maddie that this was her backstory, but it affects her. It was a trauma that she never resolved, and it comes out in her parenting. So she becomes a bit abusive and emotionally neglectful. And we learn more about Livia, who feels resentful that this other kid gets to grow up with their dad, and she's kind of marginalized in the family. She's only the weekend kid. She doesn't even have her own room. It's also the guest room. We learn a little bit about Phil's mother. So the last story is narrated from Emily's point of view. Emily is the mother, and we meet Emily in Light Skin Gone to Waste also, but there's more of her in this book. So the trajectory of Light Skin Gone to Waste was more about Maddie's feelings about the town, similar to Homegoing, because Maddie goes back to the town and confronts some of the people that she had issues with. But This book is, I think, is more about the spiritual trajectory of the family as a whole. And so the generational trauma and the impact that parents have on their kids, and how that can be carried forward to the next generation. And in a couple of cases, it appears that maybe the trend, of the poor parenting will shift. So with Livia, when Livia is about to become a parent, she s really starts setting boundaries with her father and decides that she's not going to allow him to run her, her family. So she sets a boundary and she tries to overcome the resentments that she has so that she doesn't bring that mess into her relationship with her daughter, who's on the way. And Maddie has a different experience. So Maddie's not a parent, but she does find a way to move forward in her life and let go of some of what the abuse that that she endured, and she separates emotionally from that. So both girls, I think there's hope that both of them will recover and have happy lives despite all that went on within the family that really injured them emotionally and a bit physically too, but more emotionally and mentally.
I agree that Where is Home is more spiritual. It also has a mystical element. Speak about that.
Yes. So when I first submitted the book, it didn't have the first story. It did have the last story. So the last story that I mentioned is narrated from Emily's point of view after she dies. And Crystal asked for an introductory story for the collection because if you hadn't read Light Skin Gone to Waste, it might be confusing as to like how the family ended up here. And so she wanted an introductory story so that we could understand why the Arringtons are in this town in the first place. So that was my task, but she also asked me to think about balance of the story, the types of stories. And so since the last story was narrated from a character after she was dead, my idea was to have the first story be narrated from a character before she's born. So that's Maddie. And Maddie is in the other realm, deciding to incarnate into this new life. And she is the spirit of the mother that abandoned Velma in when Velma was a little girl. And so she's returning. She's picked Velma because she wants to return to repair that relationship and to help heal Velma. So that's her goal and that's her reason for incarnating. But as she's watching her parents, she sees that this might be a bit more challenging than she had originally thought. And as it turns out, she's right. It's quite a challenge to heal Velma. It's maybe beyond her capability. And when she incarnates, she doesn't remember all of that. She in one story, she feels like she has a sense of that past, like she can almost feel it, but she doesn't remember her previous life.
Every one of those characters has been hurt in some way, and everybody is trying to heal the best they know how.
Yeah.
Would you read for us a little bit from the book?
Sure. The passage that is most prepared is the opening of the novella in the book, which is called the novella is called But Where's Home, and the entire collection is called But Where's Home as well. And this is from Maddie's cousin's point of view, Susie. We're in Monroe, New York in 1980. So Maddie is 17 at this point, and Susie's 18. So one day, my mom tells me Aunt Velma told her that Zeke Odom finally asked Maddie out. We're excited for her, but Aunt Velma read it in Maddie's diary. So we can't say Snickers till Maddie asks Aunt Velma if she can go, which is like a whole week later. And then we all have to act surprised. I do act surprised, but then I feel bad and tell Maddie, her mother told my mother, but I tell her she can't confront her mother because then my mother will know I told, and Aunt Velma will know my mother told, and that would be a mucked up mess. According to Aunt Velma, Maddie's been writing in her diary about nobody but Zeke Odom since she was in the 7th grade. I'd die if I had only one cute brother to choose from all these years. Dag. If Maddie lived around me, she'd have dated a few cute boys by now. What Aunt Velma doesn't seem to know is that there's another dude Maddie kind of likes, but he's white, like Snow White, like a Viking. That's what Maddie calls him. Guess she didn't mention the Viking in her diary, or maybe Aunt Velma doesn't want to tell my mom that Maddie liked a white boy. Anyway, when Zeke Odom picks Maddie up to take her to the movies, according to Aunt Velma, he just toots the horn outside. Now, in the boy's defense, Maddie and her parents moved to a big ass estate in a neighborhood across town, this white town, from where they used to live, and the main house has an insanely long driveway. My mom says it's not that impressive because it's not like Monroe is Greenwich, Connecticut. It's nothing but a hick town filled with average white folks. According to my mom. Maybe so, but it's easy to see how it could be intimidating because you can't tell which entrance is the front. The only door you can see from the street side leads to an enormous glass porch that kind of looks like a greenhouse, and it doesn't have a front door look. The real front door is up a stone stairway around the back that leads to a patio that overlooks a red bean-shaped pool, and down a hill behind that, there's a tennis court. And there are two cottages. The small one is close to the main house, and the bigger one is like an acre away and sits above the tennis court at the opposite end of the property and has its own driveway. I mean, Hicktown or not, maybe Zeke Odom was like, what kind of palatial craziness? The place looks like a small village. Maybe he didn't know where the hell to go. Maddie tries to run out the front door, which is, as I said, in the back, but Aunt Velma grabs her, rubs some rouge off her face, and says in that gritted teeth Aunt Velma growl, "You're not going any damn where. That kid needs to get his ass out of his car and come to the door like a gentleman." He beeps again, and Maddie sasses off to Aunt Velma, "You're crazy, let me go." And when Aunt Velma doesn't, Maddie, risking her life, says, "You're just jealous, 'cause no one likes you." And then Aunt Velma pops Maddie in the mouth. I'm hearing this on the extension while Aunt Velma is telling my mom as if slapping Maddie is as normal as making dinner or walking the dog. My mom doesn't say it to Aunt Velma, but later she kisses her teeth and tells me, "Your auntie Vex with that arrogant man she never should have married and taken it out upon Maddie." I've been telling my mother about this stuff for years. She didn't believe me. Since we were small, I've been seeing Aunt Velma pop Maddie, sometimes for little things like eating the last snack cake or leaving a towel on the floor. And just a few months ago, I was at the house when redheaded, freckled, peppermint patty looking Lisa Megna, who used to be their next door neighbor before they moved, called Maddie and asked to borrow a pair of crutches that were in their basement. They weren't even Aunt Velma's. The previous owner left them there. Maddie brought them upstairs and asked if Lisa could take them. Lisa was on the line, and I saw Aunt Velma morph into a maniac. Her eyes flashed wild and she chased Maddie around the dining room table, holding up one of those crutches, screaming, "What have I told you about putting me on the spot?" Finally, she caught Maddie and beat her to the ground with that crutch. I was shaking, didn't know if I should be scared, sad, or call the cops. We went into Maddie's room after and she cried. When I told my mother, she said, "Yeah, stop them tales about your auntie." Then she waved me away like I was a funky smell. But I did try. So Zeke beeps a third time and Maddie starts crying. According to Aunt Velma, she's crying because she thinks Zeke's gonna leave, not because she just got hit in the face. And when he beeps a fourth time, Maddie rips her arm away and runs off. The boy never does get out of the car, not even to open the door for Maddie. Aunt Velma says Zeke has no damn class, and on that point, I concur. I'll stop.
Fabulous writing and fabulous performance, Tony Ann.
Thank you. Thank you. I love reading Susie. I like her voice is fun.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite character?
I mean, I guess Susie's one of the favorite characters, but she's not one of the main characters. Maddie is based on me, but she's not my favorite. I think I enjoy writing and reading both Velma and Susie the most, because I think their voices are the most fun. But there's things I love about all the characters, like Phil, for example. Phil is a psychologist and psychoanalyst, but he's nuts himself, and I find him kind of amusing because he's crazy. And that, I'm sorry to say, that was my experience of my father. He was a highly educated psychoanalyst. He had two PhDs, and I mean, I'm sorry, two master's degrees and a PhD and a postdoctoral degree. He was very smart. But he was incredibly eccentric, and he did things that were very odd and indefensible. But justifying those things, the way he justifies them in his own mind, was funny to me, and fun is kind of fun writing from that perspective, and sort of remembering how my father sounded and how absurd I thought he was sometimes when he would say, that he was right to bring his girlfriend to our house when my mom was at work. I mean, that's just insane. Insane. But it was fun writing from his point of view, and also trying to figure out, how the loss of his father really wounded him in a way that he never healed from. And he didn't have support for his grief when he was a little boy. I don't think it was like that at that time. Somebody died and you just kind of went, you picked yourself up and went forward. But he was only 10 years old, and his dad was the parent who was more nurturing to him, and so losing that was devastating to his psyche, I think. So all of that was kind of interesting, and Livia too, is interesting, because even though I'm the sister that she resented, that my sister resented, I understand her point of view, and I empathize with it. And I think some of the ways our parents navigated her re space in the family, I think were insensitive and unfair. I think she deserved better. So yeah, I don't I'm not sure that I really do have a favorite, because they are my family, so they're sort of all my favorites and all my antagonists at the same time.
I think they are all wonderfully complex and vivid and alive, but my favorite is Maddie.
Oh really? Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I'm glad. I had a professor, one of my professors from 20 years ago, came to my launch, and he bought the book and he read the book, and then he wrote to me and he said that his favorite was Livia because she's the only sane one, and it hurt my feelings. But everybody's entitled to, their own opinion. But I am so happy that you liked Maddie best.
And I can empathize with her desire to belong and to fit in and to feel safe. And here is a question. What does it mean to belong? What does belonging feel like?
I think belonging feels like you're in a space where the people around you are kind of delighted to have you there, that you're welcomed and loved and celebrated. And I think I feel that with some of my friends, and certainly with my partner. I never felt that way as a child, in any setting, anywhere. And I also think that if you didn't have that as a child, I think it's important to try to cultivate it within yourself, which is, this is just an odd concept, but the idea of loving yourself and sort of enjoying yourself and being delighted by who you are is very healing and fortifying, I think. And for me, I guess there was a bit of sadness that, that was something that I had to cultivate for myself. But I think at times, like everybody, could use a bit of that, because if you're relying on your self-worth from external sources, it's so vulnerable, because if somebody has a bad day and they're not nice to you, then you're crushed. And I think I just got tired of that, of feeling like, I had to be a certain way to fit in. I think what I was looking for was to be loved as I am, even if I make a mistake. And I can do that for myself. I can't necessarily expect anybody else to love me unconditionally that way, but I can give myself that grace. And so I think that's the best belonging, is when you cultivate that and you love yourself. But if you are lucky enough to be some, in a space where when you enter, people light up and they're just happy that you're there, I think that's a wonderful type of belonging also.
Have you heard the expression, friends are God's apology for your relatives?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And I feel like in my life, I started to shed friends who I didn't feel that with. Like, oh, so I think starting like in my 40s, I started to do that, is like, this person, I just don't feel like they really even like me. Like, why? I don't know why we're still friends. And I just started, removing people from my life that I didn't get that sense from. And so my friend circle grew smaller, but it expanded again.
Your two latest books are linked short story collections. Did you flirt with the idea of writing a novel instead?
I never did really. There was a point in the development of Light Skin Gone to Waste where I was being encouraged to turn it into a novel for the marketplace, to try to sell to a commercial press. And I worked with an agent on that version for 5 years. It was still sort of like, it was still short stories, but the way that the agent had it put together, she felt that it was a novel. And that didn't sell, and I took out some of the stories that I had added, and I put it back together, and I sold it as a story collection. But the original idea was always that it was going to be short stories, because I was inspired by Junot Diaz's book Drown, and also Sherman Alexie's book The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven. And I discovered these books sometime before, between 2007 and 2008. It was in graduate school, and I saw how each of those writers mined autobiographical material for their fiction, and how the stories worked together. And I wanted to do that. Like, that made sense to me, because when you're telling an autobiographical story, it's not the same as, one contained story with one arc. There's multiple, you're mining memories and things, and they're not always consecutive. But, when you have some distance from it, you can see how something that happened, when you were 6 years old can come up again when you're 40 years old. You can see that trajectory, but it's not like you're following the 6-year-old, through conclusion to her journey, or even the 40-year-old necessarily. So it's non-linear. And I love linked stories, and I also really love writing in the point of view of many different people. I hear their voices, and I love the difference in people's voices, and it allows me to approach the stories from multiple points of view, and from like with different techniques. So, for example, in But Where's Home, I have a first person plural story, the we voice, and I wanted to do that, and I love, like, playing with that, and then there's a couple of second person stories and some first person address pieces, and I like mixing it up that way, and I feel like the short story collection form lends itself to that. But that said, both books, I have had people call them novels. So even though they're linked collections, they're cohesive enough that you can read it as a novel, and that's great. But I never set out on my, of my own volition to write either any of the books as a novel. I always wanted them to be separate in a bunch of stories that I put together.
All the books you've published have been published because they've won awards or at contests at various presses. As a writer and as a publisher, I need to ask, how is this even possible?
I think it is possible because I wasn't able to sell them, in the commercial marketplace. No big fives wanted my books. But publishers of literary fiction and readers of literary fiction liked them, more so than commercial presses. So I can understand commercial presses, didn't think that these books would find an audience, and so they landed, in places that wanted to give them an opportunity to be available to readers. And it's also, I submit widely. I submit like everywhere. So it may seem impressive to have, ha to have won these three contests, but I got a lot of rejections too. So there were plenty of contests that I submitted to that I didn't get anything. Not only was I not, picked, but I wasn't even a finalist. So it's just, if you keep submitting, if you're tenacious about it and you believe in your work, somebody will find it and like it if you don't give up. Like if you put the book away in a drawer because it didn't win, a couple of contests and you give up, it's not going to get published. But if you don't give up, you'll succeed eventually. So that was my experience with But Where's Home? I submitted in 2023, I submitted to every short story collection contest and I got nothing. And then I like worked on the book a little bit more and I sent it out again, and Crystal had readers reading it, and she said that it stood out to her readers, and then she had a bunch to pick from, and she agreed with, the people who screened for her. So I think it's just being tenacious, and of course it's a bit of luck too. I think you kind of generate your own luck when you're hopeful and when you submit as much as you can and do everything you can to try to get somebody to notice your book. It kind of generates some luck. So I think there's that also.
And also, nobody would know how many times or where it didn't make it.
And except I just told everybody.
Well, I mean, that's inspirational. I think people need to know. The other thing to keep on remembering is that all it takes is one. Just like with getting married or getting a job, all it takes is one.
Or getting an agent. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I tell people. I mean, I definitely cheerlead for other people to keep submitting, especially like I've met a couple of people who have been like first runner up in a contest, in more than one, and I just know that if they keep trying, if they keep submitting, they will eventually win. And the screening judges change from year to year. So sometimes, like for the Flannery O'Connor Award, the judge may be there for 3 years or 5 years, but each year that judge has people screening the material for them, and it's like four or five people, I think, and that changes every year. And so you didn't, maybe you weren't somebody's top pick 1 year. If you try the next year, it might be a different person and you might be the top pick then. And that I think that's happened to people with the Flannery O'Connor Award, just having submitted multiple times and eventually winning. So I do recommend not giving up. If you finished a whole book, I mean, you kind of owe it to yourself to do all that you can to get it published. And if, also contests aren't the only option. There's university presses, and also you can find an agent and maybe be lucky enough to sell it to a big commercial, a big five. A lot of people have done that. That wasn't my experience, but that's a valid experience that, has happened to plenty of people. And some of those books are very successful.
Do you still wish that for yourself?
I do. I do, but I'm not displeased with what I've accomplished so far. I think, sure, I would like to be published by a big five and have a big book deal and have like the force of a real marketing team behind my work so that it could reach more readers. I would love that, but I didn't want to not publish, as I waited for that. I would rather like have my work out there. And I guess the best case scenario would be like some book in the future with a big press gains the attention of the public and that leads them back to my previous work so that they could read that too. But I think, for a career in publishing, it's not about one book, it's about your body of work. And I have been building a body of work, and so, I'm good with that. I would certainly love to make more money and reach more readers. That would be great. But I also want to keep publishing and just keep putting my work out there, for the time that I have left to actually be writing and that I have something to say. So I don't want to limit myself by, if something doesn't sell, I'm not going to say, well, just forget it then. I'm not going to try to get that published. Somebody will publish it. Somebody will publish my work. So that's the goal is, keep publishing, hope for a big sale, and keep moving even if I don't get that big sale.
Whenever I finish a book-length project, I inevitably have a few weeks, if not months, where I'm feeling lost without a new project that can, take my creative energy, and give me direction. Do you experience that kind of pause and exhale?
I haven't in the last few years because I've had so much to work on. So when I finished the long version of Light Skin Gone to Waste, the one that didn't sell, I started working on a novel. And then, but I was also submitting, so I ended up getting the short version of Light Skin Gone to Waste published when it won the Flannery O'Connor Award. But then I had the stories that were left over, and I didn't want those to just not see the light of day again. And so I was already thinking about, okay, well, I think I can make a new book with the leftover stories if I fortify the collection with a few new stories. So I was thinking about that, but then I was also working on the novel that I had started revising when Light Skin Gone to Waste didn't sell. So I still haven't finished that novel. I mean, I've finished drafts of it, but it's still not quite ready. So I have that to work on, and that'll probably take me, another. Whenever I get back to it, it'll take me another several months to do that. So I just haven't had that experience lately because I've been working on both of these projects, the stories about the Arringtons and this other book for years, for so long. Like I started working on Light Skin Gone to Waste in graduate school in 2007, and I've been working on it until 2024 when I, well, actually early 2025 when I wrote the a new story that was the last story that I've written in that series. And then in the interim, I got notes from my agent on the novel, and so I have a big revision that I have to do on that. And so it's gonna that's yeah, I feel like, yeah, I just have so much that I want to do. But I find the promotion that I'm doing right now like exhausting, and it's a different energy than I need to actually work on my writing. And so I haven't been working on that book. I've been trying to promote this book. So I tried at first to do both, but I just can't do it. I can't focus well enough because I've always got something else to do. So I need periods where nobody wants to talk to me, where I can actually like really write. I don't I can't I'm not the type of person that can do a bunch of interviews and then write later in the day. My brain just doesn't work like that. I get like revved up and then I can't calm down enough to go deep and think and write. So I have to wait until I stop promoting and then I'll go back to that book.
I absolutely understand what you're saying about not being able to just switch between
Yeah.
one and the other because it's not about brains so much. I think it's about personalities, whichever personality needs to come and be dominant.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. That's absolutely true. I think when I'm promoting, I am a different personality than when I'm writing. I'm like a weird hermit when I'm writing. And I'm much more subdued and quiet, but I can't be that subdued, quiet hermit when I'm promoting. I have to be on in a different way that I'm not when I'm just writing.
You know, Tony Ann, your book slash your books are worth it very much. Every day and every hour that you put in promoting them and standing behind them, that's important.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about your writing and editing process.
Well, I mean, I can tell you about this book. I got notes from Crystal about revising this whole manuscript, But Where's Home, in late December. So it was December 19th, so a little past mid-December. And the book was due on January 15th. And she wanted me to add two new stories. So she wanted the opening story, but then she also said, "Do you have any stories that didn't make it into the other book or this book that you could add to kind of fill the collection out?" And so I did have an old story, but I had to rewrite it almost entirely. So I had to do that, write the new story, and then there was another story that she wanted me to separate into two stories that became Far Away From Here and Far Away From There. It was originally one story. So I had to do all of that starting at the end of December because I had a vacation planned. It was Christmas. My partner's birthday is on Christmas. So I had all these family obligations, and I couldn't start working on the book until December 31st when we got back from our vacation. So I started working on the new story then, and then I had to finish everything by January 15th. So I wrote and edited round the clock. Like I would get up really early. I brought my laptop into my bed and I was just sitting in my bed with my computer for, I mean, 8 to 12 hours a day, maybe longer. I just like worked as hard as I could. And if you had told me like months before that this is what I would have to do, I would have said, "There's no way I can do that. I can't do that. I'm not going to make that deadline." But somehow I wrote the story. I revised the story that I had not published before, which was the one about Phil. And I didn't publish it before because I thought it was too nutty, but it went into the collection. And I separated those other two stories. And then there were sort of some general notes throughout that I had to address. So I did everything pretty much within like 15 days, which I don't think I could do it again. I mean, maybe I could, but I don't want to work like that again. But the editing process on this book was fast and intense, and really hard, but But I'm glad that I had that deadline, because it forced me to do it. But the longer version of, my process on these books is this is like very slow over many years. So the stories, the bulk of the book was written, and it was written over a period of like at least 10 years. So some even longer. So some of the stories, going back to 2007, that was more in the Light Skin Gone to Waste, more of those stories. But the stories that were not from Maddie's point of view, a lot of those I started in 2016 and just worked on them over time, over the years. I had them published in literary journals, revised, and when I got to this book, I made more changes. So I edited those like over a longer period of time. And I think that's particularly because they're autobiographical fiction. So they were things that I was mining, throughout the course of my life, really.
That short deadline, it probably saved you from overthinking.
Maybe because I really did have to just submit it. So I thought the first story was so bizarre because, it deals with like reincarnation. And also, everybody doesn't notice this, but there's a lot of rhyming in the story. If you read it aloud, like you would notice that it rhymes.
I didn't have to read it out loud. I was going to
Okay.
ask you about the rhythm that it sounds so lyrical.
Well, I didn't want it to rhyme, but that's how it kept coming out. Like it was almost as if my brain, my creative brain was just fighting me. It was like, "No, this story rhymes." And I was like, "Oh, this is so weird. Like, who does that? Who
Nabokov.
writes a
Nabokov does that.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I'm in good company, but I thought it was so strange. But I did not have time to undo it. And so I was like, well, I guess this is just how it's gonna be. And I submitted it and I never talked to Crystal about it. I didn't ever get any notes on the story. But they didn't reject it. So I was like, okay, well, I guess they think it's all right. But I thought, oh no, this is so bizarre. And when I was sending the book out for blurbs, I was like, oh, I hope they'll read past the first story because I know that first story is just so weird. I hope they'll keep reading. I was very insecure about that story, but some people really like that one.
I love it.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In so many ways. So, do you have more plans to write about the Arringtons?
A little bit. So I have some stories that I there's one story that's a draft is written, and it's about Maddie in her, I think in her 30s in New York, and it involves like a friendship and dating. And I think I would like to do a collection, not entirely about the Arringtons, but I think I'd like to follow a couple of women in the 1980s, in New York. And their dating lives and friendships, and Maddie would be a part of that, and so maybe the parents would play into that as well. I don't have any concrete plans for another entire collection about the Arringtons, but that could change. I really need to revise this novel that I've been working on for so long, and this novel is based on a play that I wrote when I was in my 20s. And was produced in 1999. It was also produced earlier, but a main production in 1999 happened. And I've tried to expand it, deepen it. So I've been working on that for a really long time. And right now, the novel version of it has been hard to crack, but I'm still hanging in there, like working on that.
What do you hope readers will take away from your latest book?
Oh, I get asked this question all the time, and I would be lying if I said that I had a specific thing that I hope people take away because I think that people bring to their reading who they are. I think that is in play as much as the content that's in the book. So I told you it hurt my feelings when my professor said his takeaway was he loved Livia. That was the best character. character, not the character based on me. But I don't, but you know what? I'm happy he read the whole book, and that if that's what he takes away and he read the whole book, like that's amazing to me. That's amazing that somebody's invested their time, to finish one of my books and get something out of it. So I think that people will get out of it what they need. Readers who come from toxic families, I have heard one reader in particular shared with a mutual friend that the book helped her to understand things that were going on in her family that she hadn't quite considered. And so if that's the takeaway, that's great. Somebody who doesn't come from a toxic family is not going to get that, from this book. They might, be able to see it, but it'll be more distant for them. And, maybe they'll take something else away. If all they take away is, it made them feel something, it made them laugh, or it made them angry, or it made them cry, like, great. Like, I want readers to take away what they need, what is good for them. But I can't be married to one particular experience, or I'm going to be disappointed, because that's just not how it works. It doesn't, everybody's different, so everybody's going to take something different from it. And I really am just happy if people read the whole book and enjoy the writing and get some emotional experience from it. That is great for me.
Thank you, Tanya, for coming on Accents, and thank you for this conversation. Thank you for reading. Thank you for answering my questions. I admire you and your writing and your persistence and your career arc so much. I can't wait to read what you write next.
Oh, thank you, Katerina. Thank you so much for having me. This has been one of my favorite conversations. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.